Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, you and I are actually heading off to New York because we have the Jerusalem Post conference coming up on Monday, right?
That's right. Should be a really interesting one. The tickets are sold out, but you can watch live on jpost.com on Monday. It's all day, basically.
Yes.
New York time, though.
It's going to be a long day, lots jam-packed, lots of amazing speakers. We have Defense Minister Benny Gantz, who's coming, Israeli Communications Minister Yoaz Hendel. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Tom Nides is flying to New York for the conference. We have a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Meir Resnick, a couple congressmen. We actually have confirmation from the governor of New York, who will also be coming, the mayor of New York, and the list is endless. You're going to want to watch this, so you can find it on jpost.com. And maybe we'll bring some voices and sounds from the conference next week to next week's podcast. But until we get there, Lahav, a lot going on in the news here in Israel and anything that has to do with Israel. And one of them is the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Liz Truss, who people here tend to like, I think, right?
Yeah, everyone I talk to that has dealt with her in Israel really likes her. They think she really gets it. She's just a big advocate for a strong relationship between the UK and Israel. I know conservative friends of Israel, which is, of course, based in the UK, not here, but they were very sort of confident that she would be, you know, a good leader for their cause, although they also liked her opponent, Rishi Sunak. But she has a really positive record when it comes to Israel. She was previously trade minister, and she really prioritized a UK-Israel trade deal when Brexit was happening. And as foreign minister or foreign secretary, they call it there, she had a really close relationship with Yair Lapid, which will, of course, serve them well now that they're both prime ministers, although we don't know how long Lapid will stay prime minister.
Or how long she'll stay prime minister. British politics are no less volatile than here.
True. But at least she, in theory, is supposed to have a term of about 2 years, whereas Lapid's term is, in theory, supposed to end by the end of this year, unless he's elected again.
2 years is generous here in Israel.
Right.
But she's also made comments about moving the embassy potentially to Jerusalem, right?
Yeah, she wrote this letter, and it was to Jewish voters. And one of the things she said is that she has heard from Lapid the importance that Israel puts on moving the embassy, and that's something that she will look into. So she didn't say she would, but even saying that that's something she would consider is something. I mean, you know, the UK is like a major country.
Oh, that's an understatement. It's a big country. Yes. And an important country, but it's also a country that long has been viewed, at least in the Foreign Office, as being a little hostile to Israel. And to move the embassy to Jerusalem, despite what would not be obvious Arab reservations, would be definitely something quite dramatic, I would think.
Yeah, they've long been considered a country that has very strong relations with Arab states and takes their view strongly into consideration. So it would be a very big deal. It would be a big change. So in the past several years, I would say with conservatives in power, the last few conservatives who were in power, they did sort of pressure the Foreign Office to change a little bit and shift on that front. I was just reading, we had a column by Mark Regev last weekend, and it was like a farewell column to Boris Johnson. Mark Regev was a longtime spokesperson for Netanyahu in English, but also was Israel's ambassador to the UK. And he was saying how Johnson, as foreign secretary, personally intervened to allow Prince William to visit Israel. That was probably like 5 years ago by now. But because they had like a automatic veto on royal visits here, official royal visits, visits for funerals had been allowed before. So I mean, I expect that Truss would have a similar attitude.
If we jump across the pond for a moment, in Mar-a-Lago, there was some news that came out today. We're recording Wednesday afternoon. In the Washington Post, a story of how among the trove of documents that were seized from Donald Trump, the former president's residence, one of them had to do, was a very secretive classified document, had to do with the nuclear program of a country. And there's been a lot of speculation of who that country which country that might be. We know that Israel is purported to have a nuclear capability, and it's obviously something that would be of interest to presidents of the United States. How is that being looked at here? I mean, that whole kind of take documents home day in the White House. Have you heard anything from Israeli officials on that whole situation?
Israeli officials are not, they don't want to comment on it at this point. So I've not heard anything. I see a lot of speculation that it could be Israel. But from the information that we have, as someone who's not seen the documents beyond that, you know, pile on the floor, that was that picture that was going around. But yeah, for the information we have no way to know really what country it is. I mean, we don't even know if it's a hostile country or a friendly country. But I think a lot of people, this made people think about the time that Trump leaked Israeli intelligence to Putin in one of their first meetings in early 2017. And it was Israeli intelligence that led to this situation where people weren't allowed to bring laptops on any flights. And there was like a high security on flights from certain countries around the world because there was a concern that I think it was ISIS was going to put bombs in laptops. Mm-hmm. You know, for our purposes in 2022, what was interesting here was, of course, Trump, again, not quite caring about the classified nature of information. So, you know, we don't know that it's Israel, but if it was, it wouldn't be the first time.
By the way, it would be very interesting if the police or the Israeli Shabak, the equivalent of the FBI, were to raid the homes and offices of former ministers, prime ministers, generals, heads of Mossad and things like that. I think they would find a lot of interesting documents in these people's homes.
Probably. You know, it also made me think about Moshe Dayan, right? I think it was only after he died that people realized how much stuff he had in his home that he wasn't supposed to have. Not just documents, also all kinds of antiquities that he just, you know, appropriated.
Yeah, well, hey, when you're Moshe Dayan, you can do whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
But it is interesting, and you know, we'll have to keep an eye on that and see if that evolves into anything. But it does, you know, if we're talking about nuclear programs, it does lead us to the news this week. Defense Minister Benny Gantz announced on Sunday the appointment of Herzi Halevi, the current Deputy Chief of Staff of the IDF, who will become the next Chief of Staff of the IDF in January when the current one, Aviv Kochavi, steps down. Not sure these names mean much to people, but in Israel, because we are such a militaristic country and there still is this compulsory military service, although a lot of people don't do it, the Chief of Staff is like a celebration. It makes the front page of newspapers. When he goes into his role, some of the dailies in this country put an insert of the official portrait of the Chief of Staff. It's sometimes put up in kindergartens and nurseries. I remember in some of my kids' nurseries and kindergartens, you'd walk in, there'd be a picture of the president, a picture of the Chief of Staff.
And the Prime Minister and the Chief Rabbi. That's what I've been seeing.
Now it's the Prime Minister and the Chief Rabbi. I guess it depends which...
No, but also the Chief and Staff of the President.
Okay, you got all four. Wow,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's five. There's two chief rabbis, but I only noticed one now that I think.
And no women up there anyway. On the wall, huh?
Not at the moment, but there could be. There have been.
There have,
Well, only prime minister.
Only a prime minister. We need a chief. Maybe there'll be a female. I mean, it's interesting. Do you think there'll be a female chief rabbi before there's a female prime minister? No. Probably no. Not.
Absolutely not.
Not in this country. But the Chief of Staff, you know, to me, I think he's got a lot of challenges, right? You know, first and foremost, people are going to think about Iran. There's the uptick in violence in the West Bank. And we talked to our Palestinian affairs reporter, Khaled Abu Toama, later in the podcast, exactly about what's behind that, where it's coming from, and what's kind of leading to this eruption that's almost daily now throughout the Judean Samaria and the West Bank. But if you ask me, Lahav, I would say that his greatest challenge is going to be how the army has been politicized in recent years. And we've just seen this over and over again, especially when Israel kind of jumps from one election to the next. It's tough to be apolitical when you're running this massive organization that is so critical to this country called the IDF.
Yeah, you know, and I've also noticed in recent years, and again, this sort of escalates in times of elections, that these like culture wars, which in Israel, the culture wars are not the same as the U.S., but there's still like sort of a religious conservative pushback against sort of progressive ideas in the common space of life in Israel, and that those things become election issues, especially in relating to the army, whether it's, I don't know, trans people in the army or the army using gender neutral language when Hebrew is a language that's not supposed to be gender neutral. And, you know, all of these things are like, they're like little things, but they
please don't away. Let that happen. Please don't make that part of the elections.
No, but these things, like, I, you know, you see it on the far right, you see it on like some of the like religious Zionist party, the Noam party, which I think they're not even going to be in the next Knesset, but or it was a big thing when they were talking about putting women in tanks, which I think now there are women in tanks in the end, but it just chips away at this like ethos of the IDF being like the army of the whole nation when it becomes this like battleground of like religious versus secular in Israel. It's a sad phenomenon.
Speaking of women in tanks, one of my oldest daughter went into the IDF this week. She's not going to serve in a tank, thank God. But
Mazel tov.
Yes, thank you. Very proud that she's serving. But one of my younger daughter, she's got time, she's only in seventh grade, asked me if she could be in Sayeret Matkal, which is the, you know, the most elite unit. I said they don't yet let women in, so she started quizzing me of what combat roles women can do. And one of them, as you mentioned, I mean, you can be a pilot, you could be in a tank now, there's some light infantry roles, but the IDF really is, when it comes to gender equality, I don't know if it's, you know, where maybe the U.S. might be, but they've made some big strides in recent years in terms of opening up as many roles as possible for women in the army.
I remember like being in committee meetings on this in the Knesset years ago, and it was already at that point like 90-something% of jobs. The issue is that the some of the highest profile and most prestigious jobs are not open to women because the like physical requirements are, you know, very, very hard to meet for women.
Yes. Well, we wish Herzi Halevi a lot of luck. Comes from Jerusalem, actually comes from a family that is descended from Rabbi Cook, one of the first chief rabbi, right? In then what was known as, this was pre-state Israel, right? Mandatory Palestine at the time. But comes from an observant family, has really done an amazing career.
Lives in a settlement.
Yes, does. Lives over the Green Line and has come through the ranks in the IDF. And, you know, my take on all these things is that when they appoint a new chief of staff, like, do we really know the difference between this guy and the other guy or the other one who they were considering? They're all good people, right?
Right. It's true. And it's like, it's not like we hear what their, like, policy proposals are, right? Like, we don't know what their plan is for our national security.
No,
we
just and know they never really talk that much anyhow.
Right.
We tend to make a big deal about it, even though we don't know much about it. So maybe that speaks more about us in the media than it does about yeah. anything else. But it does lead to the last topic I wanted to touch on, which is that the IDF, because we're already on the topic, did release this week that its final investigation into the shooting and death of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh back in May, I think it was a few months ago. And the conclusion of that investigation was that she was likely killed by an Israeli soldier who shot at her, thinking that she was an armed terrorist. It was, of course, an accident, the IDF said, and no charges would be brought against the specific soldier. But this has resurfaced the whole issue, which at this stage, you know, I think it splits into two. One is the IDF going to learn the appropriate operational lessons from this whole thing? And number two is kind of more in your wheelhouse, the diplomatic and political fallout from this. Has there been any?
So, I mean, the U.S. has sort of continued talking about accountability and things like that. Like, that, you know, they were happy that the IDF conducted this investigation. But of course, there's nothing conclusive. Like, Israel also says it's not conclusive, which clearly is because of there was a lot of damage to the bullet. And by the time, over a month later, the Palestinian Authority handed over the bullet to be used in an investigation, and it was very damaged. I don't know if they damaged it or if it was just the condition that it was in the field. But anyway, So more or less, there's just been some talk about, like, can't there be a conclusive end to this investigation, which there is not. Israel released this on Labor Day, which also, I think, was, I mean, I'm sure was
just a coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. So there wasn't, like, you know, all the usual suspects in Congress and things like that. They weren't talking about it.
You know, Lahav, that's like the thing. That's that trick that they've done here for years, right? Which is,
of course,
if you want to, what's the day if you want to bury something in Israel to release it?
Friday.
Exactly. Friday, like right before Shabbat.
Right.
These are some of the tricks and the tricks of the trade that these politicians sometimes engage in.
Yeah. But interestingly, so the IDF briefed two groups of reporters, and they often do this, which is they'll have the Israeli media, which they'll brief in Hebrew, and then they'll have the foreign media. And the foreign media briefing was very heated. I spoke to a couple people who were there, and, you know, a lot of people were angry, and they basically said that the IDF had lied to them, because right after it happened, the IDF said it was probably Palestinians, right? And then only after the investigation did they change that assessment. There were some journalists who actually yelled at the IDF, at the officers who were briefing them, and called them murderers.
Oh my God.
So that was a tough situation from what I understand. And, you know, I don't think that the coverage of this is going to change in any way. I think the activists are still on it. You know, and we can all point out to the fact that the Palestinians have killed many more journalists, between mainly Hamas, but in general, but that, you know, that's not the story that these outlets want to tell.
Yeah. And I mean, listen, at the end of the day, no matter what, it's a tragedy of what happened to her, and the fact that, that she was killed while doing her job. So it's something that hopefully, again, you know, the IDF, I no doubt in my mind that such a, that is the military that I know, and I think we all know, goes to such length to preserve life and to minimize collateral damage and civilian casualties.
It reminds me, there was something else, which is that there's reports now, I had been unable to confirm, but there's at least reports that the U.S. is trying to get Israel to toughen its rules of engagement. Which, you're the military expert, Israel has pretty tough rules of engagement, I thought. And then the, you know, Israelis are always complaining that they're sort of too tough, that they put our soldiers unnecessarily in danger. So I'd like to know what you think of that. But then the other thing is, would that even help? I mean, this was an exchange of fire, right? There were terrorists shooting at Israeli soldiers, and Israelis were shooting back. And one of them thought that there was shooting coming from Shireen's direction. Right. Like, I don't see how the rule of, you know, you have to tell someone to stop and you tell them to stop again and then you shoot in the air, et cetera, before you shoot a person would have even applied in this situation.
Yeah, I don't know that it would have applied in this situation, because of one of the things that we know is that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of bullets that were fired that day by Palestinian gunmen in the city. And she was sadly caught in the crossfire. But I think the lesson that can potentially be learned here is this operation did take place in broad daylight. She was wearing a vest and a helmet. It clearly did say press. Now, again, I think it was a total mistake and it was a tragic accident, but maybe the IDF could do a better job in the future of just kind of seeing who else is around and keep taking that into consideration, even if there's going to be gunfire. It's going to be hard to create more restrictions on your rules of engagement when you're getting shot at, right? You know, that's not something that the soldiers need to be able to defend themselves first and foremost, but it could be that you could get a little more intelligence, use drones. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's maybe some ways that they can just have better oversight of what's happening on the ground, especially during the day when these operations take place. But we just have to hope that this will be an isolated tragedy and won't repeat itself, Matt. For now, we'll move to our interview with Khaled Abu Tuamad, the Palestinian Affairs reporter for the Jerusalem Post. Stay with us. Khaled, great to have you with us. There seems to be an uptick in violence in the West Bank. There was the attack in the Jordan Valley against the Israeli bus. And as of Wednesday afternoon, Israel was still looking and hunting for the third perpetrator or third suspect involved in that. But it seems that there isn't a day that goes by without some sort of violence between Palestinians and Israelis, an attack, clashes, shots fired. What is causing this uptick in violence?
Well, I mean, there are several reasons. According to Palestinians, if you, first and foremost, they blame the Israel. They say that it's Israel's military actions in the West Bank that are causing these attacks. That these attacks come in response to daily Israeli incursions into Palestinian cities and daily killings of Palestinians. That's how they are presenting it. They're saying, oh, it all started because of Israel. We are just responding to what Israel is doing. That's number one. Number two, you ask Palestinians and they tell you that there is growing cooperation between several armed groups in the northern West Bank, especially. And we're talking here about three major groups: Fatah, the ruling faction headed by President Mahmoud Abbas, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad. And it is this cooperation that is bringing, you know, that is causing this escalation over there in the northern West Bank. And number three, people would tell you that the Palestinian Authority is not really moving to stop these armed groups that are operating over there. And it's because they're either unwilling to do it or they don't want to confront these groups. So these are the three major reasons why we see this escalation right now.
Do you think that it's going to continue? I mean, if those are the reasons, I don't really see like an off ramp anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, look, it all depends on the Palestinian Authority, to be honest with you. I mean, the Palestinian Authority has 70,000 officers in the West Bank. And if they really wanted to move against these groups and rein them in, they can do it easily. They're already arresting many people, but they're not really arresting, Palestinians who criticized the Palestinian Authority. If someone posts something on Facebook, they go after him, but they're not really making a real effort to disarm these militias, to crack down on them, and to stop them. We see a lot of parades, for example, so-called military parades and marches that these armed groups are organizing on the streets of Nablus, on the streets of Jenin. And the question that many people are asking is, where are the Palestinian security forces? Why are they absent? Why aren't they trying to stop these gangs that are not only carrying out attacks against Israel, but they're also intimidating the local public?
Khaled, one of the things that you wrote recently was that what these terrorist organizations are hoping for, Islamic Jihad, Hamas, especially when it comes to the West Bank, is to destabilize, to weaken Abu Mazen, to weaken the Palestinian Authority, and hopefully to lead to its collapse. Is that something that's even possible? And Israel would not want that to happen, I'm guessing.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt that Hamas and Islamic Jihad's ultimate goal is to see the Palestinian Authority collapse, to end the rule of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Now, that's not going to happen as long as Israel is sitting in the West Bank. That's number one. And number two, it's not going to happen as long as the Palestinian Authority security forces remain loyal to the Palestinian Authority leadership. We don't see any attempt by the Palestinian security forces to revolt against the current leadership, despite the widespread discontent and frustration with the leadership in Ramallah. But I, as I said, you know, as long as the security forces are there, as long as they are loyal to President Abbas and the PA leadership, we're not really going to see Hamas and Islamic Jihad take over. But there is no doubt that the growing presence of these gangs, these armed gangs, on the streets of the West Bank, it does undermine the credibility of the Palestinian Authority. It does weaken them. It does make them look as if they are not really in control. What we are witnessing right now is Palestinian Authority control during the day in the Palestinian cities, and in the evening or at night, it's all these armed gangs that show up on the streets, and they are roaming the streets, and they are really calling the shots at night. And this is very bad for the Palestinian leadership if it really wants to assert its control over these areas.
Do you think there's a connection between what's happening in the West Bank and also what's happening with Israeli Arabs and the really high level of crime we've seen in recent years? I mean, we know that the Israeli Arab criminals often get their weapons from the Palestinians, but the sort of spike in crime on the other side, is this going in both directions?
Well, I mean, you know, the irony is that the level or the rate of crime in the West Bank is much lower than it is among Israeli Arabs. We don't really see much crime in the in areas that are controlled by the Palestinian Authority. And some people would tell you it's because it's not easy to carry out, you know, to carry out criminal activities when you have the Palestinian Authority that is very strong when it comes to combating crime, and people are afraid. They really feel deterred also by the judicial system over there. You can go to prison for several years just for robbing or stealing or committing, you know, petty crime, and people don't really want to mess with the Palestinian Authority. But I wouldn't say that there is any real connection between what is happening inside Israel, in the Arab communities inside Israel, and over there. We do see a lot of cooperation between criminals on both sides, by the way. It's always been there. It's not new. I remember during the 70s and the 80s, we had a lot of the joint Jewish-Arab or Jewish-Palestinian gangs. They specialized in stealing cars. They always dealt with or they traded with the various types of drugs. They were also carrying out, you know, many transactions in weapons. They're dealing with illegal weapons. So there's always been this cooperation between the two sides. Some Israeli Arabs purchase weapons from the West Bank, and many Palestinians in the West Bank also purchase weapons from Israeli Arabs who get these weapons either through, from gangs inside Israel or other means.
Khaled, one worrisome phenomenon, and you've also written about this recently, is that some of the people who have been carrying out these attacks or have been hunted down by Israel. There was that Nablusi guy from Nablus who was killed when the IDF tried to arrest him. There was the Dizengoff attacker a few months ago. They were both sons of pretty high-level Palestinian Authority security officers. This is not a new phenomenon, but I think to me it felt like we're seeing this a little more. What does that mean? Like, you know, you have a father who's working in the Palestinian Authority security services, is coordinating with Israel, and they, as we speak, they're still coordinating with the Israelis, and their sons are going out and carrying attacks against Israel?
Well, fortunately for Israel, that's not really happening on a wide scale, so that's a good news. The bad news is that, yes, it is a phenomena. It's always been there, by the way. But what is really worrying or disturbing is the fact that the father of these two terrorists that you mentioned, the one from Jenin and the one from Nablus, who are senior officers in the security forces, they come out and speak out against security coordination. They're condemning Israel. They're speaking out while they are still formally working for the Palestinian security forces, and there's no real attempt by the Palestinian Authority to stop them, to tell them, hey, what are you doing? Why are you inciting? Why are you calling for attacks against Israel while you are still wearing the uniforms of the Palestinian security forces? And this is what really should worry Israel and should even worry the Palestinian Authority. Now, will it spread? Will we see more of this? I don't know, but it's not new. The fact that, you know, you have people who carried out attacks and who have relatives working for the Palestinian Authority. They could be first relatives, second degree relatives, but that's always been like that. I know people, senior officers working in the Palestinian Authority, and they have brothers and cousins who work for Hamas and who are part of Islamic Jihad. So that's not new. You know, we're talking here about clans. Large families, and in one clan, you can see or you can find people who are affiliated with Fatah, and then their cousins are affiliated with Hamas, and so on and so on. So that's not really new. The question is, will this really affect the Palestinian security forces? And as I mentioned before, we still don't see signs of a mutiny. We don't really see Palestinian security forces joining these terrorist attacks. Every night, the IDF goes into Palestinian villages, the Palestinian refugee camps. We don't see the Palestinian security forces coming out to stop them, to attack them, to shoot at them. And I think that's good news for Israel that, you know, the Palestinian security forces are still under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Now, the question is, will these security forces, assume their role in combating terrorism and dismantling all these militias and confiscating illegal weapons? That's where the pressure should be right now, because this is not only a threat to Israel, it's also a threat to the Palestinian Authority leadership. And in the long term, the Palestinian Authority leadership cannot afford to have all these gangs on the streets, because that undermines its sovereignty, its credibility, and its status among the Palestinians.
So I wanted to ask you about a slightly different topic. This week, the IDF came out with its report where they said that in all likelihood, an IDF soldier accidentally shot and killed the Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. The Palestinians, it seemed, always believed that was the case anyway. So is this report having any kind of impact? What's the response been?
Well, I reported it about the Palestinian reactions 2 days ago. And, the Palestinian position is we even reject this IDF report. We want a full admission by Israel. We want Israel to openly say, yes, to openly admit that, Israel killed him. And they're also saying we want, to take this further. We want an international trial. We want to bring this case before the International Criminal Court. We want to see justice done. So the Palestinians are not really, impressed with this latest report by the IDF, because they're saying, look, we said from day one that it was Israel. And here is Israel, admitting 99% that it was Israel, but they left the 1% so as, to avoid being held responsible. And that's why we're not going to see this case die down, especially when you have all these international organizations and groups that are also manipulating this case of Shirin Abu Akleh and trying to turn it into another anti-Israel campaign or a crusade against Israel. So it will continue. It sells very well. The media is very interested. And the Palestinian interest is to keep it in the headlines.
Okay. Khaled, thanks for joining us. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please send the link to your family and friends. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all the major platforms. And we will be back next week.